This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Okay, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. Tonight, we're going to talk to another one of our regular panelists, the one and only Jim. Jim, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good.
Jim's been with us from the beginning, haven't you?
Yes.
So you're one of our ex-Mormons. If I understand right, you have resigned, right?
I haven't officially resigned from the church, but mentally I've resigned.
Okay, so you still have your membership like I do.
Yeah, I'm still on the books. I just don't want, I mean, and I've told this to the stake presidents and home teachers that have come by. I said, you know, they asked, you know, are you going to resign? What are you going to do? Because they were kind of fishing for if they had to start up a church court or not. And I said, you know, it's my time to even write a letter to you to even express, you know, my disdain. I'm just, you know, it's just hands off.
Okay, that makes sense. So are you still in the same stake that you were in when you were an active member?
No. I grew up in several stakes and several wards in Las Vegas, and I moved to the Mid-South it's almost been 3.5 years now here in the Mid-South. So I moved, you know, grew up in Las Vegas and then moved out to a very different section of the country.
So you were never active in the South then?
Never. I was never active in the South. I've been out of the church for 4.5 years now, and moved here, you know, 3 years ago, a little over three.
Now your family still goes?
Yeah. My father actually has left the church after I did. He's really the only one outside of the church. I kind of have a complicated story of how I was raised in the church and you know, my parental situation, but we can get into that.
Okay, and I take it your wife still goes?
Yeah, my wife is very active. She takes children as well. I guess it's good because I get to sleep in on Sundays and get a break from the kind of the tedious nature of parenthood. So for 3 hours. So that is a plus, but, and my wife enjoys it. And, you know, she's a very dedicated member of the church, and it's been a constant balancing act, since I decided to leave the church. You know, between us, we've managed though to keep our marriage strong. You know, it hasn't been easy, but, you know, she's still very dedicated to the church.
Yeah. Even for people who, leave the church together. You know, my wife and I, we basically left the church together, but the rules sort of change. You know, you have sex roles that are defined by the church and your relationship is defined by the church. And I don't care if one stays in and one goes out or that you both go out, or even the case when you both stay in and just kind of change your belief, you're going to have to do some renegotiation.
Certainly. I mean, the boundaries change and I guess how you define your relationship is modified, because before you had this kind of three-party system of yourself and your partner and the church, you know, but and by even just one of you leaving the church, you're cutting off the church. So it is only that kind of two-party system after that, you know, instead of the three-party system.
Right, and you know, people naturally change as they get older, but I mean, that's a huge change when you leave the church. And so, you know, in essence, you're both married to different people than when you started.
Very true. And you know, we've said exactly that, that, you know, my wife wouldn't probably recognize who I am today, you know, from when we first got married 6 years ago.
Right. So let's go back to the beginning. You know, we talked on our last podcast about ex-Mormon narrative, so we have to follow the formula, of course. So when When do you think you first started doubting or first had cracks in your testimony?
I started doubting when I was 16, 17. You know, it's just I changed the crowd that I hung out with. You know, I got heavily into the IT industry at that point, even in high school. And so I was hanging with a different crowd of individuals, you know, people twice my age that helped me question, you know, not just religion, but politics and the way, you know, different ways to look at my life outside of, you know, what the very confined lifestyle that I had at that point. And, you know, I just observed. And what really, I think, was the catalyst of my starting to question was the internet, you know, and people, you know, kind of try to discount the internet as part of what will change the church. But, you know, I really strongly think that, you know, the internet is having a clear impact on Mormonism itself. I started doubting, you know, like I said, when I was, you know, a late teenager, and then that doubt, just ballooned until, you know, and, you know, we'll get into it later, but until I, you know, could eventually take that, the steps that I could. When you're a kid, especially when you're a late teenager and you live with, you know, Mormon family, it's very difficult to step outside that.
Yeah. So how much of it do you think was just normal teenage rebellion versus having serious informed doubts?
Yeah, that's, I don't know. It's a good question. A lot of it was just kind of, you know, I want to do the opposite of, you know, what my parents and, you know, my family, has taught me. But, you know, it's at the same time, it was a lot of kind of just questioning everything that I could, about, you know, my, the way I live or where I lived or the cultural beliefs that I had. But yeah, I could see that there is a little bit of, you know, teenage angst, you know, that goes along with that. So.
So did you, were you active during that time as a priest?
Yes. I was active, in the church pretty much up until the day that I decided to not go to church any longer, finally not attend, you know, four and a half, 5 years ago. You know, I served a mission, held, you know, various callings in the church. And so, yeah, you could definitely say that I was an active member of Mormonism.
So now, when I was 16, the internet really wasn't around. What sort of resources were available on the internet to young Jim at the time?
Well, I mean, I remember using kind of the first archaic search engine, AltaVista, and I Googled Mormon, and I was just kind of surprised at what I had found. It was just this whole nother world of information. And at the time, you know, I really can remember this visceral kind of reaction, kind of this fight or flight elevation of, stress levels when I read things that were contrary to what I was taught about the church. You know, I learned about, treasure digging of Joseph Smith and, you know, polygamy that Joseph Smith had practiced, you know, all things that I had, you know, heard very small hints about, not necessarily the treasure digging, but the polygamy, but various, you know, questionable things, you know, all, and to be quite honest, a lot of it was, you know, bunk and you know, a lot of that evangelical fervor that we talked about in the last episode.
Yeah, I was wondering who was putting stuff up at that time. Most of the big ex-Mormon organizations weren't even around. I don't think. So was it mostly evangelical stuff?
It was mostly evangelical stuff, and also I spent a lot of time on IRC chat as well. And I'd kind of pop into evangelical chat rooms and just kind of stir the pot. You know, all I'd have to do is just say, "Hi, I'm so and so," and they'd ask, "Oh, what congregation do you go to?" You know, or "Have you accepted Christ?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I've accepted Christ, and I'm a Mormon." And then, you know, just you'd get this flood of you know, private messages. And let me specify, IRC's internet relay chat. It's basically a the an internet chat room board system.
Yeah, the old chat from the old days.
And you know, also a lot of the news groups, you know, Usenet alone is just a wealth of you know, pro and con information for Mormonism.
So I take it that some things at that time stuck, and others kind of. You hinted at that you could see they were kind of distortions.
If I were to be honest, at that time, I was really in full denial mode, and they were just a quote unquote flood of anti-Mormon lies. And so when I would look at that, I would, you know, try to defend it as best I could, not succeed at it very well, but you know, I was trying to defend the faith at the time, and I guess you could kind of consider me a kind of an a teenage apologist. So never was any good at it, but you know, I tried.
How did your mission shape your testimony? Was it a positive, a negative, a wash?
It was a wash. I learned a lot about myself on my mission, so you know, I don't want to say that it was a total waste of time, but at the same time, it taught me a lot about the structure of the LDS organization, and what their motives are. You know, what they cared about the most. You know, it was a numbers game. There was so much political infighting, you know, with the missionaries for leadership spots. You know, and once you'd get into a leadership spot, you had a lot of pressure on you to perform and to kind of pull numbers out of your ass.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's kind of a microcosm of the business world, but since they're, oh, how would I say it, kind of unsophisticated 19 and 20-year-olds, it's more out there. You know, they're not as coy about it. You know, so in that sense, I think I learned a lot about human nature on my mission from observing other missionaries.
Yeah, I mean, and I also, you know, it was the first time I'd really been away from that my house. You know, I guess you could consider, you know, myself a very shy kid before I went on my mission, and I came back more able to communicate with others in a rational manner. That kind of is counterintuitive, but you know, you know, I learned to talk to people and come out of my shell on my mission.
So it sounds like nothing earth-shattering. I mean, the experience you describe would be described by 90% of the returned missionaries, be they faithful or whatnot. So you come home. I assume you go back to school.
Yeah, I go back to school and jump into the computer industry and mainly writing software and doing IT at that point.
Of course, IT puts you in front of computers all the time. One time I did an informal survey of people on the chat boards, and I found about 50% of them were connected to software or IT in some aspect. So that might not be a healthy occupation for people's testimonies. There's a warning out to you, church authorities.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I left the church initially, you know, in my first real strong days when I actually decided to be vocal about, you know, my distaste for Mormonism. You know, I was in front of a computer 8 hours a day, and you know, if I wasn't working, I was, you know, on the boards, you know, messaging and trying to get feedback for, my state of mind at the time.
So, following the standard Mormon pattern, I assume not long after that, you met your wife?
Yeah. I actually went to high school with my wife, but we didn't date until I had come back from my mission. She had gone away to school, and we started corresponding, and she came back to Las Vegas following school. We got married a year later.
And she was raised LDS also?
Very LDS, yes.
So when did she first either hear from you or figure out that you had doubts?
About a year before I decided to fully cut my ties with the church, I had expressed my doubts. I was reading Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World at the time. I had finished it and said, what am I doing? I can't keep accepting something that I know isn't fact. And she kind of freaked out, and I think if I were in her situation, if I were in her shoes, I don't blame her. But she kind of freaked out and said, okay, we'll work on it. You can do whatever you want to do. And I decided to keep going at the time, to keep attending. And then we had moved, some time after that, and we were in a new ward. I didn't, have any ties to that ward, and I decided to take the step at that time to finally cut ties with the church.
Yeah, it becomes a lot easier. I know for my wife and I, that's what helped us go inactive, because we moved wards, had no ties, had no real desire to go. Where if we had stayed in the ward we were in before, where we had friends and connections, it would have been much more difficult. I would assume we would have eventually still departed, but it wouldn't have been as easy. So, I mean, there's, I guess, truth in what the church says about keeping the inactives tied into the group. And you can take that either good or bad,
Oh, certainly. Just because, it works doesn't necessarily mean as it proves the church true.
Right. So how do you negotiate the family situation today? I mean, that seems to be one of the big sticky spots for a lot of interfaith couples like yourselves.
Yeah. We just try to compromise and, make sure that the rules are clearly defined. My rule is, I never want to go to church because I feel it's, I can feel it's almost soul crushing to me to attend. And her rule is that I never, and I don't try to be very negative about the church, which, I have to keep my mouth shut sometimes. And I try not to actively, I guess, deconvert her. It is kind of, though, it is kind of the 400-pound gorilla on the, that you try to ignore sometimes.
Right. Now, do you all have children?
Yeah, we have two kids.
So,
two girls.
How do you negotiate that with the kids?
They're at a fairly young age right now. And we've had discussions about it. And, one thing that we've agreed on is that, the children will decide their activity levels. And the kind of the state right now is concerning baptism is that we're not going to have them baptized when they're 16 or 17. They can make the decision to be baptized, but my wife, she has concurred with me that an 8-year-old can't make a decision about where they're going to stand on their religion for the rest of life at 8.
True, but the kids are going to have a lot of pressure put on them.
Yeah.
That might be more difficult to do than it sounds at first blush.
It's definitely not going to be easy. It's going to be a challenge, and it's definitely not an easy thing. I wouldn't put anyone in this position because it's a very difficult process of decision making.
So it sounds like then you guys have found your kind of peaceful spot then.
It definitely is. It can be interesting at times, but you make it work.
So what about the ward? Have they all been warned off of you? Do they stay away or?
Well, the ward is kind of standoffish, and I have had very lengthy discussions with the stake pre or the former stake president here. He was my home teacher, quote unquote, for a while. And we'd have very lengthy discussions, and he'd kind of probe me and talk. I mean, we'd talk for hours about it. And he's also pretty heavily into business, so he's a pretty good, interesting contact to have too here in the area. And so we have a common, I guess, line of discussion about business when it comes down to it. The ward generally, they're friendly, but I guess they're not Utah about their approach, if you get what I mean.
How close do you think they came to disciplinary action?
I don't know. I know for a while they were probing with questions about what my intent was, whether I was going to resign or not. And I'm not quite sure what their full intent was for disciplinary action, either the ward where I left, or previously, or the ward I'm in now.
Now, do you all have home teachers in your house?
We do, but part of the, I guess, the ground rules, and they go along with it pretty well, is that they don't teach a lesson. They just stop in and say hi, and I'm comfortable with that. As long as, there's no, I guess, preaching.
So, do you attend anything like ward dinners or?
Occasionally I'll go to a ward dinner with the kids and my wife. Christmas dinners or Halloween parties, trunk or treating, stuff like that.
All right. So now going back to the sort of the issues that spawned this whole thing, let's talk again about the things that led right up to your deciding it wasn't true. What do you think were the catalyst issues?
I don't think I can pin it on one specific topic, but polygamy, and the portrayal of historical information by the mainstream church was really what kind of was pushed me out of the church. The saccharine portrayal of Mormon history really got to me. I remember, I guess, what the specific moment where I could say that I started consciously, walking towards leaving the church was, I had been back, I had gone on a vacation with my wife back to where I served my mission in Minnesota. And we went to a bookstore, and I got a copy of Abane's One Nation Under Gods.
Right.
And not to push that book or anything, because it is a evangelical piece. It got me thinking, about certain topics. And I research a specific topic in there and say, okay, well, this, you know, this is true about the Utah War, but this isn't true about, you know, some, you know, this other aspect of the Utah War. And so, you know, it gave me a starting point. And I remember sitting in a bed and breakfast in Ashland, Wisconsin until the sun rose. And I was sitting there reading that book until dawn came. And I had started, you know, the evening prior. It's almost like there's this whole other world out there that, you know, of Mormonism that you're not exposed to when you're a kid, you know, such as fascinating stuff like, you know, mysticism and the kind of the almost nature of the Mormon pioneer society that isn't sweetened and kind of trumped up. You know, it's very hardcore and gritty.
Yeah, when I first started studying in depth, that it was like the world opening up from two dimensions to three, because so much of what you get in church is so contained and so boxed in, and you find out that these were real gritty people, fascinating people, very interesting situations they were dealing with, both for good and for bad, that it was just like tasting food for the first time. I mean, that hunger and that thirst to know more and more and more about it, because it was just so interesting. So you mentioned polygamy. What about polygamy bothered you?
To be honest, and you know, I've kind of talked about this before in on the boards, but I don't consider what Joseph Smith did polygamy. I consider it adultery, you know, within the frame of polygamy, at least initially, you know, with the Fanny Alger affair and others, you know, it's basically an affair that turned into a legitimate polygamy or you know, it turned into polygamy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that from my perspective, the kind of things that Joseph Smith were doing are so common among men of power, both political and religious. You see that same thing happen over and over again, where the sexual access to women becomes a commodity that the power brokers trade in. And so he obviously slapped a religious dimension on it that was codified by Brigham Young. But I can see where you're coming from with that.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing happened in Jim Jones, you know, with Jonestown and the People's Temple and the Davidians, you name it. I mean, there's that, it's easy access to, you know, women. And it's easy, I guess you could say, for somebody to go on a power trip and do that. But at the same time, that really doesn't justify those actions.
You mentioned that it was hard for you to deal with the whitewash nature of history. Now, do you think it was the fact that the history was being whitewashed or the stuff that you were uncovering that bothered you?
It was a little of both. Instead of this kind of Disney-esque view of Mormon history, I was discovering a more detailed, spotty history, you know, that was full of, you know, bickering wives and land deals. You know, the Kirtland Bank blew me away when I first learned about that, the actual nature of it.
The anti-bank?
The Kirtland Safety Society, you know. And basically, you know, what it looked like was Joseph Smith had a pattern of using individuals for what he could, explaining it away through mysticism or religion, and then skipping town and going on to do it again. So, and that pattern really was the embodiment of my disgust of Joseph Smith, you know, into this day. And Brigham Young pretty much took that pattern and turned it into a franchise.
So there's a lot of apologists and other people in the church who know about the kind of dirty history. But because of the spiritual aspect, because of the revelations or the Book of Mormon or that stuff, they're able to excuse the sort of real world behavior, you know, the banking and the property dealing and all that. Did that influence you at all? I mean, why is it that the spiritual side, the Book of Mormon, didn't influence you more to stay in the church?
Because generally the story of how that information came about I didn't accept that story. You look at, for instance, you know, the Kirtland Temple, and that same pattern of revelation. Basically, you would fast for 24 hours, you would get them slobbering drunk, and then you would implant, you know, specific memories that would further Joseph Smith's agenda at the time. You know, things like, you know, for instance, because for a while, even when I was growing up, you know, there was that, well, there were the witnesses to the Book of Mormon, you know, they actually saw the plates. And then when you start digging into it, you learn, well, no, they didn't actually see the plates. They saw them with their spiritual eyes. And by the way, they were so snockered at the time that they could have been told that, you know, they saw the flying spaghetti monster, you know, for what that matters.
Okay, so to play devil's advocate a little bit, you know, some of the things you're talking about here, like what happened at the Kirtland Temple or the witnesses, you might argue that the evidence either way is sort of sketchy. You know, we rely a lot on firsthand experience. So some people, you know, give full deference to the church's interpretation. And some people give full deference to, like, the anti-Mormon interpretation. Why do you think the one version of the story, you know, it resonates more with you?
Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is usually the answer to the question. You know, did this miraculous, you know, once in a lifetime or once in, you know, the existence of the earth occurrence happen? Or was it just a con man playing games with gullible Hicks?
So you talked about Sagan before and then Occam's razor. I take that to mean that for you, you were taking more of a rationalist approach, that more like rejecting the whole idea of that spiritualism altogether, not just in the case of Joseph Smith.
Yes. I mean, I try. I can't say that I'm, you know, I do that to a perfection, but, you know, I try to be, you know, deductive in my reasoning, you know, about this. I don't really subscribe to any spiritual path, I guess you could say. I'm not one who puts much stock in religion.
So speaking of spiritual experiences, when you were an active believing member, did you have any spiritual experiences?
I guess
try to avoid recontextualizing them. I mean, that you would have said were spiritual experiences at the time.
Well, we retextualize everything that we do, you know, from, you know, even when we were believing Mormons. But, you know, that's a pretty interesting topic in itself.
Yeah,
you could say that I had spiritual experiences. I had times where I felt peaceful. And I had emotions that you could say were, you know, feeling at ease and, you know, one with, you know, my fellow man in the universe. But, you know, at the end, I was still kind of feeling empty after after the endorphin rush was over and I crashed. You just want more. You know, it's like any drug.
Right.
And, you know, it just built on top of each other. And you can never quite get where you want. I was always frustrated with that aspect of the church, and maybe that's why I never really, could claim to be very spiritual either, is because I just, it's hard for me to get emotional about something so external.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what was the hardest part of the church for you to let go of?
I would probably say the allegory of the temple was one thing, the temple experience. Maybe that's why I ran to Freemasonry a few years after leaving the church. I would say the whole temple experience, but at the same time, I feel very differently about the temple now than when I left the church.
You know, that's interesting because in the previous podcast with Seth Payne, he brought up that the temple is a reoccurring theme of something that annoys a lot of people. It just goes to show that we each, interpret and digest it differently, because to you, that was more something that was something to be lost when you left.
Yeah. I mean, I also knew kind of what I was getting into thanks to Google, but, I knew that it wasn't, the curtains would part and, I would be, given, some secret knowledge or something. It was more of a song and dance.
I wonder if that's possible that Google will have reverse effect. I remember reading about when the Freemasonry ceremonies were first published, that mm-hmm. there was uproar among the Freemasons that this was, awful. Of course, you weren't supposed to reveal the secrets. But it turned out that most of the people reading them and using them were Freemasons, and it was used to kind of improve the ceremony and make sure they were on target and to memorize it, that it turned out to be a net positive for them. And then maybe the same right for young Mormons who Google the temple ceremony, they're better prepared. They're not as frightened or taken aback when they go through that. Maybe it'll play into the church's hands. I don't know.
I don't know. That's a good question. People try to make a direct comparison between Mormonism and Masonry, but to a degree, they're very similar in the mechanics of the ceremony. But the meaning of the ceremony is very different, depending on who you talk to. I mean, but yes, Freemasons, what they think of the ceremony, and you'll get six different interpretations of it as well.
Right. I'm not a Freemason. I've read quite a bit. It's been an interesting subject to me. And I look at Freemasonry in the church the same way, I don't know, Joseph Smith was riffing on Protestant services. If you look at Mormon chapels, you look at the way the service is organized, he was obviously borrowing ideas not from the Book of Mormon or not from the Bible, but from American Protestant culture. Similarly, and that was one of Joseph Smith's talents, to take what was around him and incorporate that and refeed it back to people in a way that kind of packaged the old in a new way. And I think he was doing the same thing with Freemasonry. He was just riffing on it.
Yeah, and also he was a very politically minded individual as well, and being accepted as a Mason in that day and age was very beneficial to one's standing in society. It's that's waned over time, but you can still kind of see it as a way to have another social network.
So as you've been involved in the disaffected Mormon underground online for quite some time, and what do you think are the biggest challenges in terms of that the church faces today?
The challenge presented
by the internet and
by the internet, access to information is always detrimental to tyrannical groups. I think that the more people see that there's other individuals out there who are struggling with the same questions and the same issues, the more easy it is to wrap your head around the fact that things can change and that you can take control of your life. I think the internet empowers people.
So on a related note, with this podcast, Mormon Expression, what's your goal in participating?
My goal is to, I don't know, I like the sound of my own voice. Does that count?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I like to talk, and I love to talk about Mormonism, because even though I've left the mainstream LDS church behind, you know, it is still a part of my culture. And it's always something that's going to be in the back of my mind. You can't get, you know, you can't be in it for 25 years and then step outside of it and say, oh, well, I guess that's it. You know, it's a very all encompassing kind of mentality that remains with me, you know, even today.
That's true. And as I have a lot of ex-Mormon friends who have been out now 5, 6, 7, 8 or more years, it sticks with everybody to some extent, but people like you and me who keep engaging at the level we do are a little bit rare. I mean, most people sort of step away. Why do you think we keep it up? What is it about it that we can't let it go?
That's a good question. OCD, there could be several reasons. I don't want to play armchair psychologist, but I think I have a tendency to focus on certain things, and Mormonism, you know, was something that I focused on inside the church, or when I was inside the church. You know, I don't see that necessarily as changing when I'm outside as well. I guess, you know, it's something that was very life changing, and I'm just trying to understand myself better. And by participating, you know, in the podcast and on the boards, and it just is kind of, you know, tells me more about myself and gives me a sounding board, not just for Mormonism, but for other topics as well.
Yeah, and it's kind of an unfair question. I mean, if you devoted as much time to college football or model railroads or ham radio, I mean, no one would bat an eye, you know. But you devote the time to, you know, like Mormon studies and the internet and the boards, and some people think it's unbecoming. But I find that those people tend to want to control the message. You know, it's not just that they think it's distasteful that you're participating. It's that they want you to shut up.
Yeah. I mean, and that was the big thing is, you know, because when I initially left the church, I had my participation on the boards specifically. I mean, for 6 months, I participated at exmormon.org, you know, at a constant, pretty constant pace. But also I had a blog on the side too that I'd just write pages and pages and pages of, you know, information of, you know, what I'd experienced in the church and what I disagreed with and, you know, where I stood at that moment. And at the time it was pretty full of bile and anger, you know, and that's calmed down to a degree.
Yeah. I mean, it does wane with time, and, you know, I find myself more interested in, you know, my interests are really the doctrine and how it changed over time. And then the kind of the culture and even the subculture of how the apologists and the ex-Mormons and the post-Mormons and all that interact, that becomes a thing in and of itself. So I see that as fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely constructive. You know, it's helped me learn a lot about academia, that's for sure. And, you know, what constitutes truth.
All right. Well, Jim, it's been fun chatting with you. Do you have an email you want to throw out there if people want to contact you?
Sure. It's James@MormonExpressions.com.
James@MormonExpression.com. All right. That works. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right. If you want to follow up with this podcast or any of the others, be sure to check us out at MormonExpression.com. You can call and leave a message at 801-906-6722. or you can email us at mail@mormonexpression.com. Our music is provided by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com.